Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided by Voice Republic at httpvoicerepublic.com.
Blog Talk Radio.
My gosh, you are not going to believe what they are talking about on the Strong Stance.
Good evening, back to us listeners, Strong Stance listeners. I thought we were going to drop an ad in there, but I guess we will get to that at some point soon. Thank you for joining us tonight. I just want to thank everybody for every month kind of joining in with us in these topics that we have. It's, you know, here at Back to Us Radio, we're a big family. It's a labor of love, and we love what we do, and it makes it all the more worthwhile when everybody joins us. So we've got another great show for you tonight. Tonight we are going to be talking about social work diversity and mental health. But before we get started, I do want to mention that our sponsor tonight is audible.com, and we will be getting that ad up just as soon as we can get that to play. Technical difficulties is the life of a radio show being played live. But we want to thank audible.com, and we will have that full ad up for you to sign up and get a free book just as soon as possible. In the meantime, our topic tonight, you know, a lot of people have been talking about this issue with everything going on with certain people in the public spotlight and with mental health and depression and how there's that whole concept of he appears to have it all. But most people acknowledge that mental health issues aren't handled as seriously as other health issues like cancer and other chronic diseases. And there are misunderstandings and victim blaming and the inaccurate belief that, you know, somebody living with a mental illness or depression can simply just cheer up or get through it or get over it. But what most people don't know is the diverse ways in which social workers and the social work practice exist in the world of mental health and mental health care. There's not only a myriad of ways that social workers practice, but also a requirement within the social work code for diversity and cultural competence, and, of course, an ever-present need for diversity among the actual providers. And so we're going to be discussing these issues and their impact, of course, on the trans community as well as the community at large. And with us tonight, we have a wonderful guest, and his name is Julian Harris. He's a second-year MSW student at Howard University, where he is concentrating on mental health and trauma, and he is currently interning at the Wendt Center for Loss and Healing. He formerly co-facilitated DCATS of DC Area Transmasculine Society Support Group and was a team leader for HIPS. And Julian is a black trans man living in Washington, D.C., and we are very grateful for Julian taking time out of his very busy schedule to join us. So, Julian, thank you so much for coming on the show. How are you doing tonight?
Absolutely, doing pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. This is something that you and I have both talked about because, you know, as I mentioned, you're in your second year pursuing your MSW, and I have a BSW and MSW as well. And you know, I loved it when you told me you were going back to school to get this because I was like, yeah, one more thing that we have in common we can talk about. And, you know, we've had this discussion a lot about the different ways in which social workers are viewed and, I think that each of us have our own opinions, but I'd love to get from you your perspective of how you see the social work practice overall, particularly how it kind of intersects with mental health.
Well, one thing that a lot of people don't understand or know or acknowledge is that most of the mental health providers in this country are social workers. Actually, the NSAW report, that 60% of mental health professionals are clinically trained social workers. And that is compared with 10% of psychiatrists, 23% of psychologists, and 5% of psychiatric nurses. Also, you know, like you said earlier in the intro, most people think, or a lot of people think, that social workers are there to take away your kids, that they can be anyone who, you know, volunteers and does social, or people who do social service work or work for the government. However, social workers provide mental health services in a variety of settings. Some of those are community mental health programs, disaster relief programs. You know, when we had our that shooting at the Navy Yard here, social workers were down at the Navy Yard and different places around the city providing relief and crisis counseling. Social workers are also found in employee assistance programs as therapists there. They work in the military and veteran services. They have private practices. They're in schools and rehabilitation programs. And, you know, social workers are specially trained. They utilize a person and environment model that views people as part of systems such as families, organizations, and communities. And, you know, they're specially trained to treat, assess psychological issues that that affect the way people function in their daily lives. So, you know, social workers play a large role in the mental health fields in this country, a lot more than what people would think.
Yeah. I think that what's also very important is the fact that, you know, in certain places, people do think that the only thing that social workers do is handle foster care. Or, you know, maybe it's just clinical. You come into an office, make an appointment just like a psychologist or a psychiatrist, when in reality, you know, like you said, it's all throughout every facet. You know, I think that one of the things that was most telling for me when I was in school was that I had an advisor in the counseling department that said, you point to an industry and I'll show you where a social worker could fit in. And so even beyond even the counseling session, like, you know, you can have industrial, you know, folks that work with people that have lost their jobs, or, you know, even if it's not counseling, one of the big things that people often forget is also social workers are involved in activism, and which is why, you know, one of their core, you know, concepts is cultural competence and diversity, because you work with so many different people in so many varying settings. I mean, to be honest with you, for those of you that know me, like I said, I have 2 degrees in social work. I'm a database administrator. And many people have come to me and said, I don't understand how you're working in this field. How'd you get these jobs without an IT degree? And the fact is, the last couple jobs that I got were because I had social work degrees, because it put me at a really good ability to interact with people and be more of a trainer, as well as, you know, kind of showing people the ropes of something rather than going, this is how it is, and being very dry, like being able to kind of, one of the big things that I remember being taught and in our program was meeting people where they are, that you can't expect people to be where you are. You got to meet them where they are. And so I think that if you add those kind of skills into almost any setting, it's going to make a social worker's job better. It's going to make their clients' lives a little easier when they come at them from that way, because if things are hard enough to where they're already needing social work services, the last thing that they need to do is bend to someone else's will and say, oh, well, you don't understand this, so I got to be where you are. Instead, a social worker's job is to meet the client where they are.
Right, exactly. And like you said, part of the code of ethics is, you know, well, and cultural competence and social diversity, but also taking part in social and political action. And as we know, you know, social work goes back to social justice. And that's something that I think when people first start and first, you know, go to school, they're like, yeah, I want to do social justice. But as you go further into the profession, sometimes we lose sight of that. And that's something that I think that social workers need to remember is one of the core values is social justice.
Yeah, and I think that what's really tough, too, is that especially when you first come out of school and you just need to get a job, and many social workers are woefully underpaid and very much overworked, and so you get a lot of burnout. And I think that that's why sometimes it's easy to kind of forget that social justice concept. I think that one of the things that I always kind of knew going into social work, unlike you, and I'd like for you to talk a little bit in a minute about what your kind of what your field is mostly about. But when I was in it, I was like, I know that I do not want to do direct services as far as counseling and things like that, direct clinical services, because I didn't want to be a clinician because I took it home with me. I mean, when I was doing my internship at the district attorney's office, it was so taxing, and it was hard for me to separate it from my life. And so my concentration was actually in program and agency administration. I figured that maybe one day I'd open up a queer youth center or do something like that. And actually that concentration has helped me in the world of business. But I always am fascinated with the different concentrations that folks in the MSW program choose, because I feel like it's very telling of their personality and also how strong they are internally as a person and the ability to kind of to give of themselves so much. And so I'd love it if you could kind of talk a little bit about what you're doing, both in your concentration of mental health and trauma, but also maybe a little bit about internships that you've had or things that you've done with regard to loss and things like that.
Okay. Well, one of the things that is extremely important that we talk about in my current internship is self-care. You know, when people think of self-care, it's like, I think that some people don't understand how integral that has to be in your life when you're a social worker. Some of the things that you're privy to or you witness or you hear about in social work can have residual and lasting effects. There's something called, I think it's reference trauma, but it's trauma that kind of you take on even though you weren't part of the original trauma and things like that. So self-care is something that we take very seriously and we have to do to make sure that we can continue this work. What I'd like to do, what I'm really interested in, is loss and loss and trauma in marginalized communities, especially transgender communities of color. As we know, there is a lot of loss in that community, in those communities.
Yeah.
There's loss of family, loss of friends. It's not just literal death loss, but there's that too. There is loss of employment, loss of, you know, everything that anything tangible that you've had can come to an end. And so those are things that I'm interested in kind of developing programs around, kind of working with people one-on-one on. And so that's what, you know, I'm focusing on right now. In my internship, it's really interesting. I'm with the Wendt Center, and I feel very lucky to be there. There's a number of different programs that they offer there. And I'm going to plug them at the end because I think that they're a wonderful organization. That anyone dealing with loss, you know, call them, and they have a number of great services. Going there and working with the clinicians there, it's really been teaching me how to really, you know, do self-care, you know, take that time that you need for yourself to make sure that you're okay so that you're able to assist others.
Yeah, and, you know, I think I'm sure that you, and I wonder, did some of that start? So, Joanne, I'm not sure if you know this, but we have actually mentioned HIPS and even had Cindy as a guest on the show before. And so for those of our listeners that do recall, HIPS is this really great organization that basically, you know, they help out all different types of, you know, communities in D.C. They focus mostly on sex work and a lot of the trans community in D.C. They go out on a van that's very cute, soccer mom van full of condoms, and they do needle exchange and condoms from, you know, late at night during the weekends. And one of the things that HIPS really taught us, because we both volunteered together there, was about self-care. So did that kind of start to spark your interest about self-care and dealing with loss in that way, or does your self-care kind of interest even go beyond and before our time at HIPS?
Well, I knew that, you know, time for yourself, time to kind of reflect, meditate, whatever you need to do to kind of center yourself. I knew that those types of things were important, but I think that our time at HIPS and also our time at, I don't know, you're still with DCAT, really made me think that social worker was the thing for me, because I was kind of working in different fields. I was doing economics and I was doing airline type work, and it just wasn't fulfilling. And I think that work with those organizations doing harm reduction and psychoeducation and things like that really kind of pushed me into the social work realm. And I thought self-care was just kind of, I didn't think that there was like a class taught about it. You know, and I didn't think that, I just thought it was something that people did when they needed to kind of debrief or kind of needed to center themselves. But starting back in school and having my internships, that's really when I started to think about what self-care really meant for me, because it's different for every person. And not one technique works for everyone else. You know, yoga may not work for me, it may not work for you, but those experiences have really just pushed me into the field of social work. And hopefully, at my age, I'm like, I don't really want to go back to grad school, but I think this is probably, I think I've made the right decision.
Yeah. Hey, man, you're doing great thus far through it. So I think that you absolutely made the right decision. So before we get into some details specifically about how a lot of this does affect the trans community, I want to kind of back up and look at how mental health affects just the community at large. And I think that, one of the things that I had mentioned in the intro was that it's not taken as seriously. It's not seen as something as serious as other illnesses like cancer or high blood pressure or diabetes. And, some people will point to, oh, these things can kill you. I'm like, guess what? Depression can kill you too.
Exactly.
And so I think that it's kind of important to look at the concept of how, whether it be depression or bipolar or any other kind of mental illness can affect people in the community from a large range. And I think that two of the well-known examples, of course, of people who, as I had mentioned, people that, they seem to have it all, was, of course, everybody knows that just recently Robin Williams committed suicide, and he was the classic example of someone that could make everybody laugh, seemed like he had everything going for him. His whole life was just had it made. There's not a place you could go in this country and mention his name and nobody know who he was. And so I think that is always the biggest blow, is when you have someone commit suicide that it was just, they had been hiding it for so long. Oh gosh, how could he have done this? And I think it's telling of how people cope and hide things away from everyone. And you really have to wonder kind of how that happened. But I feel like Robin Williams is one of those stories where everybody's kind of dissected it. And one of the people that you had told me about, I've heard of the show, but had never really known of the person, was Josh Marks. So if you could tell some of our listeners kind of about Josh and how people would know of him and kind of a little bit of his story.
Well, so Josh Marks was on this pop show, Top Chef. And, while he was on the show, I think he got diagnosed as being bipolar, and he was taking care of that. He was taking his medication. And then he just got worse after he lost to, he came in second place. He was given another diagnosis of schizophrenia. There's a real, like you mentioned earlier, sometimes people don't take mental health seriously. Well, in addition to that, there's a stigma. So people, you can say, I have high blood pressure. People aren't afraid to invite you to a party because they don't think that you're going to, your high blood is going to act up and you're going to do something crazy. But, if you say, I have a mental illness, I have bipolar, schizophrenia, then, you're going to be kind of socially ostracized. And, that happens. But going back to Josh Marks, it looks like, he had it all. He was doing great. No, he didn't win, but, he was well-known. He was a great guy. Everyone seemed to like him. And he would have had more opportunities for him. But I think that these examples of Robin Williams, Josh Marks, and other famous people just kind of, solidifies what clinicians and researchers have been, kind of telling us. Depression affects anyone. Mental health issues affect anyone, no matter your social or economic status, how good you look, whether people love you or not, whatever your material possessions are. A lot of times, celebrities, we see them with a lot of substance abuse issues and things of that, which, many times is an indicator of their internal pressure, internal struggle, or their emotional pain. They're extremely reluctant to seek services. you know, because it's going to be all over the TV. It's going to be all over the news.
Right. Right. And I think that there's also value in looking at the, I mean, there's many sides to mental health, but I think that there is value in looking at both what some people would call just a clinical, you know, chemical imbalance, something that's like, I have depression and it's because of a chemical imbalance and it's something that I'm going to have to treat possibly for the rest of my life. And then other mental illnesses, which are just as valid, and I think that that's another thing that people don't really get, is when your mental stability and mental health is affected by environmental factors. You know, you had said something before about, you know, losing, you know, a job, employment, losing the, you know, your community. I think that another thing that people don't realize is that one of the reasons why, this is my personal belief, is that one of the reasons why it is so important for social workers to be involved in social justice work and activism work, because having inadequate access to healthcare, having inadequate access to employment, having all of these things that just kind of knock you down a peg in what our society says is the cream of the crop or whatever, affects your mental health. It affects your psychological well-being. And quite honestly, you know, there of course is a point where no matter how much money you make, it doesn't really matter much in your mental stability. But having adequate access to healthcare, being able to meet your bills without stress all the time, being able to walk down the street and not worry about someone, you know, catcalling you if you're female, or being, you know, just a horrible person because you belong to another minority. Being a person of color in our society, as I'm sure you know and can attest to, is not an easy thing to do. And when people ignore the fact that, you know, everybody always says sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, is the biggest lie we ever tell our children. It is the biggest lie we ever tell our children, because words that are thrown at you take longer to heal. The scars inside take longer to heal than a broken bone ever will. And it affects people's mental stability. It affects their psychological well-being. And I believe that that's why it is so important for social workers to not only practice what they practice, but also to be part of the activist world and social justice work, because, you know, the whole point of being a social worker is to try to work yourself out of a job. You know, you want to fight for all the rights and win them. You want to make sure that everybody is the best that they are. And so, like, I don't know, what are your feelings around, you know, kind of the other side of the coin, not necessarily a chemical imbalance that can be treated, but something that's more about your environmental factors that affect your mental health?
I mean, when you think about, you know, transgender people who commit suicide, or transgender people who are murdered, which happens a lot here, especially with transgender women, you know, the way they're treated by society, the way people are mistreated by society, you know, that directly negatively impacts how you feel about yourself, which in turn causes depression, anxiety, all these different disorders that people have. Just because someone is of a, you know, minority, whether it's their gender identity, their sexual orientation, things like that, and that is not in itself a disorder. It's the way people react to that, which causes the problem. If you were living in a society where people who were different were given the same sort of respect and the same sort of opportunities as everyone else, then you see a lot less of these, you know, outcomes where people are committing suicide.
Yeah.
Also, you know, when you think about people who, you know, aren't celebrities or aren't rich and famous, you know, sometimes they are reluctant to go seek services because, you know, number one, it's kind of ridiculously intimidating or hard to kind of navigate the mental health system. With the new healthcare, you know, law, we're starting to see parity with the mental health services and just regular physical health services, but, you know, it takes a while, and they're not quite up to snuff yet. Also, sometimes people are afraid to seek services because they're afraid of losing their job. If you have a security clearance,
yeah,
you go to a psych, psychiatrist and you're getting treatment for some sort of disorder, then, you know, you just might lose your clearance. You know, you might lose your job. And then what do you do?
I actually know of people that were denied clearance because they had sought out mental health professionals' help within the last X number of years. And, you know, it's sad because it's like I wanted to go talk to somebody because my best friend is not here anymore or committed suicide or my family has completely, you know, disowned me. And something like that can put a black mark on your record if you do have a clearance. I mean, it's not everything, everybody. Not everybody does lose that, but I have heard of folks not being granted a security clearance because of that. And that's really sad because you could get a security clearance with a bad knee or, you know what I mean? It's like, why aren't we treating knees a little bit more, you know, adequately as far as on a level playing field? And okay. And I think it's also something that one of the things that that we talk about a lot is that one of the things that we try to do on the Strong Stance is talk about things that people don't want to talk about. You know, you were talking before about how, you know, you don't mind inviting somebody with high blood pressure to your party, but if somebody tells you they have a mental illness, you worry that they're going to wild out or whatever the fact is. But even more so, a lot of times what happens is talk about shutting down the conversation, right? Like if you tell somebody that you have a very serious illness, a lot of times if somebody doesn't know that much about it, they'll ask about it. When you tell someone that you have a mental illness, it's like silence. The conversation stops.
Right.
And what ends up happening is that it leads to a lot of ignorance. I feel like people don't understand people that have mental illness or just what mental illness is about. And, you know, that this isn't just a, okay, well, I'm just going to go talk to somebody and everything will be cured, or okay, I'm going to take a pill and everything will be cured. No, there's a lot that goes into this. It's just like any other complex illness. And
exactly.
So this again needs to be one of those things that, all right, let's put on our big girl and big boy underwear and you know, kind of really bring these issues to the table and talk about them very frankly, very seriously, and very honest and openly without getting offended if someone tells you what you are saying is wrong.
Exactly. And the stigma is real. I mean, the word crazy gets thrown around like, you know, like water. I mean,
yes.
If someone's like, oh, I'm going through something, I'm depressed, or someone has, you know, people have, you know, if you're experiencing something that's extremely traumatic or extremely upsetting, and if you don't have any outlet, and then you have, like, you're going to have a break. People have psychotic breaks. People have different kinds of breakdowns. And, you know, if you tell people, you know, oh, you're all of a sudden crazy, people are afraid to go to therapists because they're all of a sudden going to be crazy. And, you know, honestly, I could feel like, okay, we should maybe take this word out of the vocabulary because it's really causing people to neglect their mental health because they're afraid of being labeled. Mental health needs to be taken, you know, people need to, you know, just as we go to get our checkups once a year, our physical checkups, our physicals, our dentistry, our eyes checked, our hearing, whatever, you know, mental health screenings and just kind of like talking about what you're going through. Everyone struggles with something at some point in their life. And the thing about mental health or mental illness is the longer it's left untreated, the worse it becomes. So you could have something that's totally manageable, but you neglect it, and then it becomes something worse. One thing that social workers believe is that, you know, most of these things are, you know, you can recover. Just like any other ailment, you can recover. And so that's something that social workers, you know, work with clients to do, to help them recover and to be able to live their daily lives without the problems that this particular illness is causing. And so, you know, if we could, as a whole, as a community somehow, get the word out that, you know, mental health is just as important as that physical you take every year.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that some clinics are trying to to make that a priority. I know that when, so as most of our listeners know, I am a patient at Whitman Walker. They have a wide array of services from mental and behavioral health to medical, you know, physical health, dentistry, and all that kind of stuff. And they have within, and I could be very wrong, this could be a longer term thing that they've been doing, but I recall that every year when I go in now, and I, like I said, they could have been doing this for a while, but now every year when they look at my record, when I go in just for a regular checkup, they're just like, oh, it's been a year, can you fill this out? And they just, I mean, it's a slim sheet of paper. They could probably, you know, maybe it would be better if I was going to see somebody and talk to somebody, but I was like, you know, the first time they handed me that, and it was asking me, do you feel down this many times, or have you ever had this issue? Because they just want to make sure that there's at least some kind of screening. And so I found that that was interesting. Of course, you know, it's a baby step, but it's better than nothing, and I hadn't ever had to do that on a regular basis elsewhere. And so I'd like to, when we come back from the break, I'd like to talk to you about maybe some of your suggestions about how we can do this better, and then we've got some, you know, some things that, of course, we're going to talk about more specifically to the trans community. But for right now, we are going to take a break and hear a little bit from our sponsor.
Okay.
Audible.com is a proud sponsor of this Back to Us Radio podcast. Audible.com is a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/back2us. Again, audiblepodcast.com/back2us.
So that was the amazing ad that we were having some small difficulties. I'm so glad that everybody got to hear that. Please, everybody should go check that out with Audible. They are an amazing service. You can get, like you heard the ad say, a free book just by signing up via that link. And we will mention that again for those of you that didn't hear it. You'll get a chance to grab a pen, piece of paper, and write it down. But, of course, we'll always have it on our Back to Us pages and Facebook fan pages. So coming back to the issues that we were talking about, you know, so Julian, I was just mentioning before the break that that Whitman Walker started putting into place this sheet of paper with a series of questions that kind of asked you, you know, just kind of checking in with you, but some of them were mental health. It also asked you about sexual and behavioral health as well. What are some of the things that you would recommend for larger scale clinics like that to, because obviously we don't force people to go to the doctor. We don't force them to go to mental health professionals. But what are some of the ways that we can start to break down that stigma and start to check in on their clients on a regular basis to kind of go through those screenings? Do you have any suggestions about what healthcare professionals can do that might be listening?
That's a tough one. I think that
I like to throw the tough ones. That's what we do here.
One of the things I think people can do is kind of provide wraparound services, you know. So if you are treating a patient, you need to treat them holistically. So that, you know, in my mind, I'm like, you know, sometimes, you know, you go to a doctor for, you know, an internist or a primary care. You know, they've had training in mental health, I believe, some of them, most of them, probably. But at any rate, you know, maybe have them, you know, at least give referrals or, you know, like you said, give you that little questionnaire, template questionnaire regarding how you're feeling. Have you ever felt suicidal? How many days are you depressed and things of that nature? Because those things really do get the conversation started. But, yeah, I think it could be quite simple. I think people, you know, medical professionals could just kind of treat the patients holistically by, you know, not only talking about their physical health but their mental health.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that maybe one of the things that maybe should happen a little bit more is that in larger clinics like this where, you know, you have a cross-departmental kind of thing, kind of like Whitman Walker, and I don't know if they do this, but what would be really a great idea is, you know, every doctor has to go through continuing education, right? Every social worker, every medical health, every mental health professional has to continue to go through continuing education. And I think that one of the things that would be very important to see more medical doctors go through is a little bit more of a mental health kind of series of ongoing education. Because when you're doing a regular physical screening, you know, with your patients for their physical health, it might not be a bad idea to know a little bit about something so that you can pick up on some of the signs. You can ask them the right questions just in your regular, how have you been feeling, any chest pains, any whatever. You can also ask them some of those mental health screening questions so that if there are some flags out there, just like if you'd ask, how's your knee feeling or how's your back? Oh, my back's been hurting. Well, I'm going to refer you to, you know, this orthopedic surgeon to have that checked out. You could refer them to a mental health professional. I think that that would be very beneficial so that for people that aren't going to take that extra step to go and get a mental health screening, that maybe they could kind of two birds, one stone. Because a lot of times people will listen to their doctors. The doctor says maybe you should go talk to somebody. Maybe they'll take them up on it instead of making that first step themselves to find a doctor. I feel like if a doctor has someone to recommend, maybe that's a good place to start. It takes a lot of the work out. So I don't know if that's something that you have ever been involved in, on whether you have kind of a cross-departmental kind of, you know, continuing education, anything that you've been involved in with the NASW or anything like that.
Not currently. No, I haven't, you know, I've seen where that really takes place yet. But I'm hoping, you know, I'm hopeful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, spitballing, like throw out ideas. So, so one of the things that we had talked about before was we had mentioned several times, obviously we tend to focus on trans issues on this show. And so one of the things that I think is very important is we talked about kind of the two sides of, and it's more than two sides, I'm just presenting two sides of the coin of, you know, there are folks that suffer from a physiological mental illness, whether it is a mental, like a chemical imbalance or something that can be treated with pharmacology or something like that. And then folks that are affected by, you know, mental illness based on their environmental factors. And sometimes that's both, right? And I think that what is important is that when a lot of folks look at the trans community, when they talk about depression and suicidal tendencies in the trans community, yes, a vast majority of it is because of environmental factors. It's the reason why the stats are so much higher, and we'll talk about some of those stats in a little bit. But I think that what's also important is to remember that trans people, at our core, we're just people. And so we can suffer from the same chemical imbalances that anybody else can, and maybe it's not because we're trans or because we don't have those civil rights. Now, not having them can make the other part a whole lot harder, but you know, I mean, I think that that's a really important mark to look at all the different ways that the trans community can suffer from mental illness and all the different causes that can kind of contribute to it.
Right, exactly. I mean, when you look at the statistics like you mentioned, I mean, the chasm between cisgender people and transgender people, it's wide. I mean, let's talk about this. I mean, there was a study done by the National Center for Transgender Equality here in Washington. It's 41% of the trans respondents said yes to the question, have you ever attempted suicide? And to me, that's just kind of unacceptable.
Particularly when you compare it to the fact that only about 1.6% of Americans across the board have stated that they have attempted suicide during their lifetime. So that's
right.
41% of trans respondents, 1.6% of Americans in general.
Right. And that just,
like, that's ridiculous and jarring.
Exactly. Recently, I know we talked about this last week, there was a young man in Philadelphia who committed suicide. Apparently he was suffering from depression. He had recently come out in his school. I think he was in 11th grade. His name was Riley Matthew Moscatel. And, you know, it's not clear whether or not he sought out or received any mental health services of any kind. What is clear is that, you know, this young man didn't have the support that he needed. in order to feel that his that he could go on with his life. And that's really, I mean, we see way too much of this. I mean, you and I have, you know, people who have, you know, taken their lives, and
yeah,
it's just, you know, when is it going to stop? When are healthcare professionals going to start realizing that transgender people are part of the population of people that they're going to be serving, and actually begin to educate themselves and try to be a part of the solution? You know, and that's
yeah,
something that I think social workers are going to really have to kind of be the leader. You know, we're going to have to really take the lead on getting that education work out and really blowing the horn on that.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that social work can play such a huge role in is there was, you know, while we're talking about studies, there was a research that was published in the Journal of Pediatrics that basically compared, now granted this isn't comparing the trans community with the community as a whole, like Americans as a whole, like the last stat was. What this was, in my mind, is also so very important, is they compared LGBT young adults who had little or no parental rejection with those who had high levels of rejection. And they found that the ones that had, the LGBT young adults that had a high level of rejection from parents, were almost six times as likely to have high levels of depression and more than eight times as likely to have attempted suicide. And they also go on to say that they're also three times as likely to use illegal drugs and engage in unprotected sexual behaviors and things like that, which can increase risk for HIV and other STIs. But I think that, to me, that the two biggest ones there is that six times more likely for high levels of depression and eight times as likely to have attempted suicide than other people in their same community, but the only differing factor there was parental support. And community is so huge, because feeling like you're being rejected by the two people that brought you into this world and are supposed to love you regardless can completely and utterly shake you as a person. And
right,
for those people that have survived that, I am in awe. I can freely and openly admit that while some of the early days when I was a teenager weren't always easy with my parents, when it came to me coming out as trans in my early 20s, it was a completely different ballgame. My mother was there 100%, and I know without a shadow of a doubt that had she not been, I would be a completely different person. And I think that that is something that's so important, because social workers can not only help the individuals that are experiencing this rejection, but they can help the families get through this. Because as you and I have said several times, both in social and public spheres, is that when we transition, our families kind of transition with us.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that, you know, as in my case and many others, we, as the person who's transgender, actually have had much, much more time to kind of digest who we are, kind of think about what we're going to do. And we, you know, when we tell our family members, it's new for them. And sometimes, you know, we have to kind of give them time to understand and kind of educate them. However, I think that a social worker, the role of a social worker could be to kind of facilitate that, you know, facilitate that work where you're bridging that divide between, you know, parent and child. And sometimes the other way around. I mean, many times there are parents who come out as transgender and come out to their children, and then you have rejection that way. But I think that, you know, as social workers who are charged with being, you know, promoting social justice and being activists and non-discrimination and things of this nature, and respecting the person. And I think that social workers are really, really going to be on the forefront. I know that the National Association of Social Work has a committee, an LGBT committee, and I think it's been around since, like, 1976. Obviously, a lot of things have changed since then. And, you know, the NASW does have literature, and it does have trainings that, where it does provide education for social workers and social work students like myself, where we can kind of get education to be in the forefront of that that new change. But I think that what I'd like to see is more of that taught in the classroom. You know, I'd like to see a little more, you know, a lot of times we gloss over, you know, diversity. We say, oh, okay, we're going to teach cultural competence, and we kind of gloss over. We talk about race a little bit. We talk about gender, talk about class. And, you know, people talk about lesbian, gay. And then, you know, they kind of side note or, you know, kind of touch on transgender and bisexual.
By the way, there's a T in there somewhere. We don't, we're not going to really talk about it. We're just going to mention there's a T in there.
Yeah, not sure what it means, but, yeah, be respectful. You know, I think that, you know, in school, we need to really, really kind of educate people, because this is a population that's here. It's always been here. It's not going away. And, you know, to be effective social workers, we have to be educated in this this arena.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, what you're saying is so critical, and it's true, because it comes up so often. And, you know, we need more research, and we need more studies, and we need more looking into things, and action as well. And I think that what's really important is that finally people are starting to look at, through studies, how these different stressors can affect your life. And the American Journal of Public Health actually published a study that had a little less than 1,100 trans people. And what they were trying to evaluate was the relationship between minority stress and mental health. And for those folks that aren't, you know, familiar with minority stress, what that theory proposes is that basically the health disparities among sexual minorities can be explained to a large, you know, extent by stressors that are brought on because of a homophobic or hostile culture or environment. And it can result in a lifetime of harassment and maltreatment and discrimination and victimization. But basically what happens is that it can ultimately impact their access to care, whether that be physical or mental health care. And the connection was found among trans people as well when they did this study. They tried to apply that theory to trans people. And what they found was is that something like 44% were expressing signs of clinical depression, 33% were expressing signs of anxiety, and 27-28% were expressing somatization. And so it's important that, you know, these studies are finally coming out, but it's just important to remember that while you're doing those cultural competencies and learning about diversity and what you're going to be doing with when it comes to social work, that you don't forget every facet of it. You know, I'm from a state where diversity means, oh, we have black and white people here, and maybe there's a couple of Jewish people here. We don't talk about diversity in religion. We don't talk about diversity in sexual orientation and gender identity. That is changing, but 10, 15 years ago when I was there, that was not the case. University of Alabama, when they talked about, oh, we had this diversity conference, it was about how white people could be better allies to the black community and how they could be, to be honest, just less friggin' racist. And so, and that is super important, especially in the South. But let's call it what it is. If it's really a diversity conference, let's talk about all the different arrays of diversity. Because one of the things that you mentioned is that we do have a lot of assaults and murders of not only just trans women in the city, but particularly trans women of color. And usually they are trans women of color of a very low socioeconomic status. And so it's all of the intersectionalities of our minorities that can build to bring people down. And if we don't address those head on and talk about them very frankly, nothing's going to be done about them, and they will get worse.
Exactly. 100%.
So I think that one of the things that we've, you know, several of the things that we've talked about are all of those things. And there are stats upon stats. And I guarantee you, if any of our listeners would like to hear more stats, because there's even another study, there's, you know, Julian and I like to look up studies and look at these statistics, because stats are what stick with people. You can say sentences and, you know, you'll kind of get the gist, but numbers tend to stick with people. And there are a few other studies here that we looked up that we didn't even mention here. And And I think that, you know, and they talk about the different ways in which socioeconomic status and income and education level and all these things can affect your suicide rate. They talk about the fact that among normal populations, you know, people of color commit suicide at a far lower rate than white people do. And yet in the trans community, it is exactly the opposite. The suicide rate for trans people of color is so much higher than it is for trans people that are white and that are not people of color. And I think that that's something that we have to acknowledge and we have to address it. And, you know, I just, this is yet again, we try so hard to have those, these moments on this show and every show on the Back to Us Network where we're like, look, part of this is education and we want to make sure that everybody's opening their eyes and we're going to give you those wow moments and we want you to open up and really talk about things that people don't want to talk about. So I think that this is another subject that, Julian, I say this at the end of almost every one of my shows. I feel like we could talk about this for hours. But I want to, first of all, with the few minutes that we have left, I would like to go back and I would like for you to be able to plug the place where you are doing your internship, the Wendt Center for Loss and Healing. So if you'd like to tell our listeners a little bit more about that, how they can get in touch with them, how to spell it in case they want to Google it, things like that. I would love to for our listeners to know that.
Okay, so the Wendt Center for Loss and Healing is an amazing organization. I will give you the contact information. They do a wonderful program in the summertime with children who have lost their parents or significant family members. It's called Camp Forget-Me-Not, where they talk about how to coping methods, and they really help children out. They've got support groups. They, you know, they do a program called Recover at the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner's Office. Their phone number, 202-624-0010, is great. And some other organizations I'd like to shout out would be HIPS, of course, the DC Trans Coalition, which you probably mentioned sometimes, because they actually do a needs assessment for the trans community. Casa Ruby, which is an organization that is run and created by trans women of color. You've got Whitman Walker Health, the National Center for Transgender Equality as well.
Yep. And for those, you know, for those folks just looking for a social atmosphere, as I've mentioned several times, and that Julian and I have both at one time or another been a facilitator of, is DCATS, the DC Area Transmasculine Society. There is a plethora. One of the things is that if you live in a larger city, please, if you need someone to talk to, please do not hesitate to reach out. And if you can't find somebody, you find a way to get in touch with me or this show, and we will try to find someone in your area that you can talk to. The worst thing that we can imagine happening is someone suffering in silence and suffering alone. You aren't alone. One of the best things my mother ever told me is there's never anything wrong than with needing someone to talk to. And if you need someone to talk to, please speak up. We will find someone if you can't find someone. I will do my best to Google. It's the beauty of the Internet. I can Google the hell out of some resources if I need to. So, Julian, I just want to thank you for taking the time out to not only be here with us tonight, but I really appreciate all of the work that you brought to the table with this show, you know, knowing, you know, that you are a very busy guy that's not only in school full-time and, you know, also doing your internship. I know personally because you are pretty much my best friend that you are sick right now. So I really appreciate you jumping online even through your antibiotics. So I just want to thank you so much for joining us. And if you are willing, we would love to have you back sometime and maybe talk about another issue that is near and dear to your heart. So I just want to thank you again for being with us tonight. If there's anything you would like to say, any parting words for our guests, before we kind of close out the night, please let me know if there's anything you would like to say to our listeners that you feel is important.
Well, one thing I'd like to say to our listeners is that you're not alone. There's something about all of us that, you know, many of us feel like we're not worthy. There's things that we need to work on. But whatever it is that, you know, the thing to remember is that you are enough and that you are important. And you know, if there's something you need to talk about, don't feel like something's wrong with you. Don't feel like you're crazy. Just reach out, and, you know, there's always someone there to listen. There's always someone who's been through it.
Yeah,
so thanks, Eli.
And
so
if you reach out to one person and they aren't hearing you, please reach out to somebody else.
Yep. So thank you,
Julian,
so
I want to thank you very much. Absolutely. Absolutely, man. Anytime, you know that. So in closing, I do want to bring it kind of back to our sponsors. We have a wonderful sponsor in Audible.com. And as the ad mentioned, which we will play again, so if you want to grab your pen or pencil and paper to write down this link, it is on the Strong Stance page, and I'm sure that there are a plethora of ways that you can find it, but it is audiblepodcast.com/back2us. And what I want to leave you with is that there are two books that I would love to recommend. If you are itching to read a book and you're not sure what to read, there are two that are kind of near and dear to my heart. One of them is The Night Circus. It's an amazing book. It's one of those things where if you like circus and magic, it's a beautiful book. It's about a circus that appears at dusk and disappears at dawn. You never know where it's going to be, and the entire circus is black and white. But outside of that circus, the way that the author describes color and texture and food and flavor, it was one of the most amazing books I ever read. I recommended it to my sister-in-law, and sometimes she still looks at me and goes, I wish I was still reading The Night Circus, and I feel the same way. And the other one is, if those of you have been paying attention to the theaters lately, you've probably heard about a new movie come out called The Fault in Our Stars. That was an amazing book that was written by none other than John Green. And if you're a YouTuber, you know all about the Green brothers, Hank and John Green. It's a beautiful story about two teenagers, both who are living with or in remission from cancer. And just, you know, a cute little romantic love story about these two people who have been dealt a rough hand. And it's a great story. Be aware that you may spend a good chunk of it in tears. I've known some of the hardest people that I know read that book, and they cry and they laugh, and it's funny and it's charming, and it can be sad as well. But both of those books, if you sign up for an Audible account, you can get one of those books for free. So pick one and download it for free, and if you like it, buy the other one. So again, that's audiblepodcast.com/back2us. As always, I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in. You are the reason that we do this. We hope that we have touched someone's heart tonight. If you would like to find us, you can find us on Facebook at the Back to Us Show or the Strong Stance fan page. They both have pages. Please reach out to us if you need to talk to somebody or if you just want to drop us a line. In closing, I'd like to say I will see you next month, same time, same Bat Channel. So for Thursday, 9 p.m. Thanks for joining us, and I hope everyone has an amazing night.
Audible.com is a proud sponsor of this Back to Us Radio podcast. Audible.com is a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/back2us. Again, audiblepodcast.com/back2us.
energy. Take off all your cool, unmask all your veil. Let me move.
You have been listening to a recording provided by Voice Republic at http://voicerepublic.com.